Yes, here we are.
Second part of the lecture. The constitution of others. So I've been gesturing towards this in the earlier part of the lecture. This is Husserl's inquiry into how we constitute the being of others. So the ego, starting from itself and in itself, constitutes transcendental intersubjectivity, to which it then adds itself as an I among the transcendental others. Are you with it? You like it? It constitutes a space of transcendental others to which it adds itself. And we have this equivocation all the time about who am I? Am I this being that I in the world, or am I this being that I experience myself to be in each moment? The always singular I constitutes a first primordial sphere of objects and performs a constitutive accomplishment through which an intentional modification of itself and its primordiality achieves ontic validity under the title of alien perception. Maybe I should just start at the beginning of that sentence. For the always singular I constitutes a first primordial sphere of objects. So he, again, we could question Husserl on this, about whether this is, really is the right ordering, or why does he say it happens in this order? Because I think a lot of studies of infants and babies indicate that our initial state is being unable to distinguish ourselves from others.
Takes a few months. 3 years.
That it's an actual work of constitution to recognise that I am not my mother, you know, at a certain level, or that there is another being.
The body?
Yes. But I think, even as I speak into that, it's like there's a primordial sphere there that in not recognising that you're distinct from another, you're still in a primordial sphere, if you like. You're also not thinking I'm the same as another, because you don't have another to think you're the same as about. There just is this stream of experience within which the distinction between self and other has not been made. But Husserl regards this primordial sphere to be the place that you go into as an adult in the epoche. That place where, so I'm denied all others, the being of anyone else, as well as the being of the cups and the tables and the chairs, in terms of them having any objective being beyond my, you know, the objective being that things have is something that I grant them. It's a meaning intention that I grant. But I don't have any, in the epoche, I don't have any recourse to saying, but there really are these beings out there, really in an external world. All I have is my meaning intention that there are such beings. Do you see that's the very heart of the epoche? That my absolute certainty in the being of the cup is a meaning intention. And whether there is a being of a cup that corresponds to my meaning intention is what I've suspended. Whether there's anything beyond that. By suspending it, it doesn't mean that I've said that there isn't. What I've suspended is, in a way, my thinking that I understand that. Because, just to reiterate, I have this meaning intention that intends there to be a cup there. And what lies behind that is the unthinkable source of experience, if you like. What lies behind that is what we were alluding to at the beginning, the universe before it's unfolded into an experience. And objectivism doesn't think like that. Objectivism thinks something like this, that there really is an object, just like the one I'm perceiving, in an objective world. That's the kind of scientific picture is something like that. I'm having a bubble of consciousness experience, and the cup that I'm experiencing in my bubble of consciousness is just appearing in my consciousness. But behind that and outside of that, there is an actual cup. And not only that, it looks just like the cup I'm seeing. There's a sort of an absurdity in it, if you see what I mean. Do you see the idea that there's an exact copy, almost, of your perceptual world where the physical things really live? And you're experiencing a kind of a conscious representation of the things that live outside of consciousness. The epoche, if you like, is saying, well, we don't know if there is anything outside of consciousness, so we're just suspending that. And that seems to be okay when it comes to cups, but he's just saying, well, primordially, you're also suspending the being of all of the others, which, in a way, for me, I mean, you're all a lot closer to me than the cup. Well, no, I am immediately given to myself. Although it's a good question, because we did brush over this. You know, I mentioned Sartre and the transcendence of the ego. That in a way, I also have a meaning intention about me being an ego. That there's a kind of an enduring me. It's a bit like the cup. I don't actually know there's an enduring me. It's another meaning intention that I'm putting it like that because I sort of reflect it behind me. But that ego is the ego that I, you know, we've already spoken about. That's what's self-objectified in the world. That's the thing that endures. The egoic self that endures is an egoic worldly self that endures like the cup that was there yesterday and might be there tomorrow. But what I do know is just the endurance of this moment. And I know that immediately. I put my head around and I say, where on earth am I? Oh yeah, I was in the middle of that sentence. This was about the primordial sphere. So Husserl's saying, right, if we're going to be true to the epoche, we have to start from the primordial sphere where you're all just phenomena. I haven't constituted you as others yet. How do I do that? What's going on? What is the meaning that I intend when I look at you? How is it formed? Let's go into it. So we've got this under the title of alien perception, perception of others of another I. We're on the fifth line down. Who is for himself an I as I am. This becomes understandable by analogy if we already understand through the transcendental exposition of recollection that to what is recollected, what is past, which has the ontic meaning of a present having passed, there belongs also a past I of that present. So we're talking about recollection. We've touched on this before. So when you remember something, you were also there, right? You remember an event in your life, albeit yesterday. Going to Waitrose. There's an I as part of that story. that went to Waitrose, right? And whatever it is that we're recollecting. And we're looking at a transcendental exposition of such recollection. So I've already constituted, I already have constituted in my experience a certain meaning of my own enduring, this enduring of an I, such that there's a past I there, that in a certain sense I still am, and yet in a certain sense it's not immediately the immediate I that I am now. You see, we've got a funny relationship going with our past I. You don't think it's anyone else, right? And in a way, you've got this sort of semi-magical, in, you know, you remember what it was like to be the transcendental subjectivity of that past moment. You were the centre of it all. You remember what it was like to see out. You remember what you were feeling. You know, and we were remembering Proust and his Madeleine. You know, it can go, you know, sometimes a smell or something can suddenly transport you back to when you were a boy or a girl. You know, it's not just you remember it, but you suddenly, it connects with your feeling centre, and you suddenly, you feel, you know, I mean, this is particularly strong if you lose a parent, you know, then. You feel how you were as a boy very strongly. There's such stuff recorded in there, you know, that you just don't know about. But it's all amazing, isn't it? Just that relationship to the past that you are. It's quite even to the boy that you were, because the boy that you were, you know, in grief, the boy that you were is still sobbing. Is it you? Well, yes, but it's quite extraordinary. It's you, but then, you know, it's a shame Rekha isn't here, because she probably looks at those sort of, where you know, the adult and the child, you know, they communicate with each other, and yet they're all who I am. So we've already, before we even need to think of another within the epoche, we've already got all of our past. And our relationship with this past I, or even maybe there are multiple ones. So where am I here? There belongs also a past I of that present. So we're just looking at a particular recollection. There's a past I of that present. That present that has passed. Because, of course, you always only ever remember a present. And this is where intentionality works. Do you see that? You've got to think of it, why, when you remember, why don't you think, this is happening to me now? Do you know there's an intentionality that is able to shift it and say, no, that's past. That happened in the past. Because you could, if you have a particularly vivid recollection, you could actually feel it's happening now. Tell me more.
The girl in Christmas, the matchstick, that she remembers her grandmother, and she lives a recollection.
Yes.
Before.
But you
see, in a cold.
I don't know the story,
it's
but.
A long story, is
it? Yeah. The matchstick girl.
We don't know the matchstick girl. No, we don't know the matchstick girl.
You know it.
I heard of it.
The story of the girl around Christmas, where everybody's enjoying it, she's homeless and selling matchsticks, and then she's very hungry and tired, and she's about to die, and she lights a matchstick to warm herself, and when she lights the matchstick, and she remembers, she sees her grandmother, and then it goes, and then she lights another matchstick, and then another matchstick, and then all the matchsticks run out, and then she dies. And she likes the matchstick, that warm feeling of the matchstick the duration of the matchstick.
Yes.
And then she lights another one, and then the other one finishes. So she, when she lights it, she lives it.
And I mean, that's a lovely picture of a memory, because if, do you see that it would make sense in a way?
Isn't it Hans Christian Andersen?
Yeah,
it's
the
Christian.
Oh yeah.
I think it might be.
Yeah. So you would see naturally that if we didn't have this modification of time, understanding time past, we just experience everything now, because that's the fact, right? If I'm remembering something, I'm remembering it now, but I don't take it as something that's happening to me now. I'm like, you know, here I'm the tissue's doing this. I look into my mind, and if I have a memory, I don't think, oh yeah, I'm just seeing something now. Isn't that interesting? I understand time, and I understand that is me in a former time. Do you see? It's a pure modification of meaning. There's a pure essence of intentionality in that we can do that. We do it and we think it's obvious. Of course it's a memory. But do you see it? No, it's not. It's just a certain thing that you're experiencing now. And yet you're able to say, no, this is now and that was then. And not only that, you can picture something else about what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, you've got this. But they're all modifications of meanings of things that are happening now. Everything is always happening now. That's for sure, right? Every memory, every projection of the future, everything you imagine, and yet we've got this facility to distribute these things in a time dimension, an inner time dimension that's a sheer meaning. So, I mean, there's a punchline coming. Hopefully, we get to it. I'm in the midst of one of Husserl's enormous sentences, aren't I? So I'll start this sentence again. Hopefully we get through half of it before we forget the beginning. This becomes understandable by analogy if we already understand through the transcendental exposition of recollection that what is recollected, what is past, which has the ontic meaning of a present having passed, there belongs also a past I of that present. Whereas the actual original I is that of immediate presence. That's I here now. To this presence, recollection belongs as a present experience, in addition to what appears as the present sphere of facts. You're still sitting on the chair when you're remembering something. Thus, the immediate I performs an accomplishment through which it constitutes a variational mode of itself as existing in the mode of having passed. Yes? Starting from this, we can trace how the immediate I, flowingly statically present, remember the flowingly static presence of I? Everything is moving and in change every moment, and yet I remain, now remains, constitutes itself in self-temporalization. Yes, I remain the same. Not in recollection in the future. Every moment I remain the same. And again, this is like consciousness. I can't prove it. That's how it is for me. John, you shouldn't die off in the middle of a sentence like that. Starting from this, we can trace how the immediate, flowingly statically present, constitutes itself in self-temporalization as enduring through its pasts. In the same way, the immediate I, already enduring in the enduring primordial sphere. Now, there are two endurings there. There's the immediate enduring, which is immediately given to you. And then there's the constitution of meaning that says, and I'm the same I in that memory. You know, you could play around and say, no, I wasn't. But you can't play around and say, no, I'm not the same I in this moment. Do you know the eye of this moment, the flowingly static moment, is indubitable. It's Descartes, what you can't doubt. Whereas you can doubt the past eye, your memories could be false. Usually are. But you do you see how the constitution works? The constitution doesn't have any of that. It just constitutes the past, and there it is. Do you see the meaning intention? Even if it's a false memory, you still experience it as the past that happened to you, because that's the intention of the, in the experience. Even if your intellect says, "No, it wasn't. I don't think it was really like that," doesn't change the memory, what it's like of the memory. In the same way, all right, here's the twist. In the same way, the immediate I, Bajijing, Descartes, I am, I exist, already enduring in the enduring primordial sphere, before there are any others, before you lot turned up, constitutes in itself an other as other. I mean, what he wants to say is you've already done it to yourself. You've already de-presentified yourself into the past. Now, instead of de-presentifying yourself in time, you do it in space. You know the past I. You know there was another that was you who experienced the past, and you have the memories to prove it. Now what you do, the way that the constitution works, is you do the same again, only you do it in space. So you make another absolutely co-present with you in time, but separate in space. So you've already got the meaning structure from the primordial sphere. You see, what he wants to say is, how do we get out of the primordial sphere of me just knowing myself? Well, we get out of it because I've already constituted myself as past. And I take that constitution of self as past, and then I presentify or I de-presentify myself into you.
So we're all the same person?
Well, let's just hold on that. Well, I mean, to an extent, yes. Well, who was that person in the past, in the memory? That was me in another time. Yes? But I was in this body. You know, there's a continuity of the body and all the mannerisms and the things that happened to this body. Also, some of that happened to my previous I, if you like. But now, this is how I understand it. In effect, yes, I've now placed that I in you. But you're another body. So you've got an entirely different past, an entirely different brain. So there's a whole lot of stuff that is going to be different about your experience to do with your body, but I've de-presentified the same thing essentially into you that's in me, which you would say is my pure transcendental consciousness. Now, are there two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11 of them, or is there one of them? In a way, when I look back and at the earlier John, my sense is that there was a certain core where it's the same transcendental consciousness in the boy as there is now. All the body's changed, the experience has changed, the brain's changed, but something remained continuous. Is it the same in you? To which, at one level, you'd say, well, it depends on your meaning intention. Do you see there are, we've got a certain degree of freedom here about whether we understand another as absolutely other, or whether we understand another as in some way being me. You know, we're on the edge of love, actually.
And empathy.
Well, he calls this empathy even to get as far as to acknowledge that you're conscious like me. But then we're looking at, so how are we distinguished? We're distinguished a little bit like my past self is distinguished from me, only you're now another consciousness over there. Before this lecture, it kept coming up in me that I had a teacher when I was in Australia many years ago, and he used to love to say at the meetings, and he was a bit of a thunderer, there's only one eye in the universe. Just one. And it's sitting there on that chair.
It's sitting in that body.
It's sitting in that body on that chair, and it's looking at me. And don't put your eye on me. Or something. I'm impersonating now. Sorry, Barry. But that was the gist of his insight, if you like. That there's really only one consciousness here. Now, I don't know that. I mean, I do know that, because for me, that's true. You see, there's a level where that's definitely true. There's only one consciousness here. Here it is. I de-presentify it and into you, but there's a level of empathy that says you're like me, and then there's another level of empathy that says you are me.
Yeah. You get a very strong. I got once in my whole life a very strong feeling of that. Almost, it was so scary that I just wanted to get out of that thought, and it was so hard. It took me a few seconds, but I had two pieces of.
Yes. Yes.
The feeling was so strong, and I was so, I've never got scared in my whole life. But it was so strong that this person who was speaking to me is actually me.
Yes.
And it was so like, and I was like, I don't want to go back to that experience because it was so scary, and I wonder if that happens, how am I going to deal with it?
Yes, because it's terrifying because there's a structure in us that keeps us together as a worldly, independent self, and if that disintegrates, then there's the sense that I'm not going to be able to handle things, anything, anymore. But there's, I think there's
maybe something that's been revealed to you then.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's what, terrifying.
I mean, there are people that get experiences like that, where it's a blissful union, and it goes further than that. You know, I'm one with all of life, not just the other human beings, but all of life. And Barry, who was that came from his kind of experience of that unity of being all of life.
But isn't transcendental subjectivity like that? That's what it is.
Well, that's what that's what the thing about phenomenology is, you can only go as far as you can go, right? If you know that as a direct insight, then you do. If you don't, you don't. It's you can't make a leap of belief in a way. That's not allowed. But there's a certain level here where you can start to play with that meaning. And start to have a feeling that it is so.
True compassion, what we call compassion isn't really compassion. True compassion is if you truly are, know the other, then you truly understand what they are going through. Mm-hmm. You truly know another. It's very rare, isn't it, in practice?
Well, someone fell over one day. I was just walking down the street and somebody fell over. And, you know, like we are. I'm a human being, everything's going well today. And then suddenly, trip, boom. And I just felt that, I felt such a, you know, the whole vulnerability of our situation here as we're dreaming along in our world, and suddenly you're on the ground, sprawling. And I had a moment, you know, a moment. That's me. Do you know? I fell over. There are flashes like that, where suddenly you've transposed yourself somehow. There's no gap anymore. It's as if it happened to you, and there's such a love in it. Do you know? There's like there's something underneath here that I think the phenomenology of transcendental subjectivity has a dimension here which is only it can only be explored. If you love another, then you start to move into this area where it starts to, the distinction between you and another starts to become more revealed. It's not that you're the same either. Do you know? Because in loving another, you start to love something like the essential being of another. Do you know? You know, love is a sort of a revealing of the being of another, until you start to get to what something like the unique being that someone is. So this, and then what's behind that? You know, I feel like this sort of stuff, you can just put it on. It's like saying, just put it on the table. Do you know, it's something to. We're not looking for an answer here.
It's interesting to know what would a female and mother philosopher, phenomenologist write.
Well, that's you, Maria, isn't it?
No. No.
Well, there's only one eye in the, well, that's, there's maybe two, there's maybe the man and the woman, you know, on Earth.
No, I have a feeling it's one. It's just the experiences we have, and the language we use to describe it may not reflect the true. It's quite difficult, isn't it?
But are you looking at the connection of giving birth and having a child?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And how there was a being in there. Yeah. That being was you, right? For certainly during pregnancy, there was no separation, was there? I mean, there's not that I've experienced this, but
precisely,
you know,
that's what I'm talking about.
But seen from the outside, you'd say, "Oh, yeah, mother and child. That has to be, the. You know, I'm talking about for a man. It's more the connection with a woman. For me, anyway, is because you know that's symbolically a union too. But it produces a child, which is even more.
This is
it's another level of unity below that. That your cell is my cell, my food is your food, my breath is your life.
And your pain is my pain, which is, you know, for me it's physical, my son cuts his finger, and I'm hurting.
Yes.
He forgets about it, like, within 5 minutes, I'm still hurting. So this is why, is it like just my own experience, or this is like, what can be read apart from herself, written by a female, a mother, and a phenomenologist.
You're asking for me to recommend somebody who I've read who's said anything intelligible about this, and I can't do that. I'm already, in speaking of love, you know, starting to walk off the phenomenological page into my own reflection on this. I mean, there was of that the only there was Hannah Arendt, who came, you know, Husserl, Heidegger, Hannah, if you like, but she was I don't recall her speaking of motherhood. But that doesn't mean somebody hasn't.
He had a female assistant, I can't think of her name right now.
Husserl.
Before Fink, yeah.
Yes.
Definitely.
But they were yes. No, I'm going to be bringing something up in the next course. It was yes.
Jean de Salzman, born Jean-Marie Allemand, often addressed as Madame de Salzman.
Madame de Salzman.
I mean, I'm sure if there's something that's been written on the phenomenology of motherhood in more recent phenomenology. The trouble with me is that I don't know if it's a trouble, but I have a very strong sense that things have degenerated rather than gone beyond herself.
You know that book?
The book Nicolette's talking about is The Origins of Language and the Biology of Love.
That's it.
And we will be looking at that in the next course. Which touches on this.
It's
Umberto Maturana. It's co-written by a woman.
Artist, yeah.
Yes. And as the usual man, I just remember the Maturana's name, but there's a psychologist, a woman who co-wrote it with him, where the book itself is a consideration of that. There's two directions the human race can go in, if you like, and the feminine direction is where we're not going at the moment, and that all language came out of the mother and child relationship, that only there was it possible for something like language to be born, because language is born out of love.
Yes, next week, next
year.
Next year.
5 weeks. Yeah. 5 weeks' time, everyone. Everybody has a lot of trouble reading Maturana. I didn't, but I when I read the book, I was kept going, you must read this. Everybody. So it might be another case of, you know, John saying, well, it really does make sense. You know, there's something worthwhile in here.
It's a book called The Reality of Being by this Holzman. I don't know if you talk about that, but she talks about consciousness and being.
Well, anything that philosopher would be.
Yeah, this is
the yes. But I would not wish to. One of the things that is in a way is the point of this course, is that is not that everyone goes away and studies phenomenology. It's everyone goes away and studies their own experience. You know, this is just a kind of a getting us in the zone. If you can get into a place where you can start to peel back the layers of what's going on in your own experience, then you don't need anyone else. You know, it's the crucial aspect of this is that you're able to get into something like an epoché where you have the pure clarity of consciousness that's able to simply look into experience. That's the crucial thing. If you, you know, most people in what would be called introspection just see what they expect to see. You know, you've got a preconceived idea about yourself and about things, and then you turn that on yourself and you just see what you already saw, if you see what I mean. The whole idea of the epoché is it pulls you back into a state of pure witnessing, so you can actually observe your own experience without
the... No, those are not for self-help to help me to unlayer. It's basically, I think, relativity. Things being, it's like, you know, this illusion with one size circle being surrounded by small circles, and a circle, the same size circle being surrounded by big circles, and how we kind of been decoying ourselves.
So there's, can I just,
because
my sense, if I could try and express better what I'm saying, is that there's a certain form of understanding yourself where you've already got a framework that knows what it's looking for. There's a pre-existing understanding that knows what it's looking for, that's got a kind of a model of the psyche. And you take that model, and according to that model, this is how therapy works, right? There are things that you can do to change your the way that you operate. But the epoché is about entering into a state of pure witnessing. If you've got a model, and we've all got models, if there's any truth in phenomenology, the epoché is you've actually made contact with pure consciousness, and there's a tiny gap that enables you to see the model that you might be using. So it has no model. Pure consciousness has no model. It just shows you. It just, if you're operating under a model, then it will project the model for you. Do you see? It projects the model into your experience. But pure consciousness itself has no model, doesn't think. But in a state of pure witnessing, it's like the speed of light. Whatever's there, if you can be the witness, then it will reveal to you whatever it is that you're projecting. And phenomenology is the seeing of what you're projecting, and not doing anything about it. It's not that you're going to do any action, and it's not that there is any model, because finally, you know, if it all goes well, you don't know anything. You know, that witnessing consciousness knows nothing. It just faithfully shows you whatever is.
It's like propaganda. It's like between you and fact. It's like propaganda. And you kind of know what is propaganda and what is a fact. When you realize that, oh, this is just propaganda. And now I'm witnessing this thing. And I have no idea what it is. You just experience it.
I mean, I feel a little speech coming on about what philosophy is at this level. You end up, if all goes well, in a place where you have a certain freedom. In a way, you see that you can't live if you don't project an understanding. The only question or the only issue is, do you have any freedom in the form of the understanding within which you live? Is it one that's just been placed on you by the world, Or have you been able to, in some sense, have a hand in the creation of the very meaning that you live? And that's the epochade takes you into a place where you can start to be, if you like, a kind of a co-creator in the meaning that you live, rather than a victim of the meanings that have been kind of slapped on you. And that's a sort of a fascinating, it's a fascinating place to be. And you never really see to the bottom, I don't think. Maybe you do, but you know, you can always be surprised by things that you are actually you are projecting that you didn't know you were. I don't know if there's any end to that. You know, I'm almost going to say this is an advertisement for writing, because writing is very revealing as well. If you try and write down what it is you're seeing, you often, in the process of writing, start to see more. Writing is very useful in that way, because you kind of holds things for a little while. You know, when you speak, it's like... like now.
Yeah, so what's going on in this class?
Yes, like now. But God, what have we said in this class? Well, it's the iPhone's doing its little job of fixing it. Where are we? We're somewhere down here, aren't we? Very near the end.
Yes.
Let me start on the fifth line up. Self-temporalization through depresentation, through recollection. Right? So you've depresented yourself, as in you're not present anymore. Depresentation of my primal presence into a merely presentified primal presence. That's me in the past. Thus, in me, another I achieves ontic validity as co-present in his own ways of being self-evidently verified, which are quite different from those of a sense perception. How do we verify that the people around us are really conscious? I don't know, that's very interesting, isn't it? I tend to figure it out by the way you're looking at me.
This is what I wanted to say. Sometimes you just don't even need to prove that people are unconscious. Just be on a platform in the morning rush hour.
And you know that they are, or they're not.
They're not
conscious.
But we're still, whatever, you know, even if someone's not fully awake, we still grant them the capacity to wake up any moment. You know, we still grant that capacity to the others. I mean, I'm only bringing that up because we're going to be wondering if we stick around long enough into a strange area where are we going to start to grant this kind of being to our machines.
Well, that's interesting, because especially when people speak about Alexa or
yes.
Those machines, they're giving of themselves and make the machine do it all and then reflect back to them and Alexa turn on the heat and Alexa.
It's starting. And it ain't going to stop there, right? And pretty soon, especially if you know, you're going to be spending more and more time speaking with and interacting with a machine than you are with another human being. You're going to start granting a kind of agency. And at a certain level, you might say, "Oh, yes, I know it's not real." But what about another 50 years?
Mm.
What about when the ability of that machine to respond to you is going to be far surpassed the ability of anyone else you know? Because, you know, you're watching his Dark Materials on BBC. You know Philip Pullman's book, where everybody has their little daemon. Their little soul animal, well, Alexa's going to become your little soul animal. She's going to know you better than anyone else. She, it's not science. It's still a bit of science fiction, but it's we're going to be in a dodgy area here. The dodgy area is that if we are unconscious of what consciousness is, then we're going to project consciousness into an unconscious entity. And there are people who think that if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it's a duck. Basically, that's Alan Turing's thought, you know, about the Turing test. Well, if the machine is able to convince you that it's a human being, well, then it is. I mean, with something, you know, I've said this before, there's something terrible is about to happen if this continues. And I'm reminded again of that movie, you know, All Is Lost. Mm-hmm. There's a certain level here where I see all of humanity, and sorry to give you an apocalyptic vision here, all of humanity is just slipping into the water. You know, on the surface is consciousness and our love for one another, and we're just falling into the water. And if you want to complete the picture, you know, Husserl's hand, there's a few hands there saying, quick, before it's too late. You know, come back to the surface. Here's reality in your senses, not in the fucking phone.
You're talking Matrix now. Morpheus was.
Yeah, you know, the Matrix is you know, it's in a little screen now, but it's going to become fully immersive.
Have you seen the movie?
Yeah.
Matrix. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the movie is a kind of a philosophical thought experiment in itself. Whoever did it has obviously did philosophy at university. Where I'd be surprised if they didn't. It's because it's a kind of a thought experiment. The only thing about it was that there still was a physical reality behind it. In a way, for the Matrix, have you all seen the Matrix movie? Yeah. Yeah, what spoilt it was there was a physical reality with physical machines. And in actual fact, the Matrix we're caught in, there's no physical reality behind it.
They still had the cellar, didn't they? It's a kind of a movie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. That's right. We couldn't have gone too transcendental. Actually, you know, behind the movie, there's transcendental subjectivity, everyone, and we can't actually show you that. But I'm sure you all understand what I mean. It's right. I thought I got to the bottom. Oh no! I just skipped a whole slide. Thank you, Nicola. All right, the paradox resolve. Only by starting from the ego, this is a brand new one, is it?
Yeah.
Only by starting from the ego and the system of its transcendental functions and accomplishments can we methodologically exhibit transcendental subjectivity and its transcendental communalization through which, in the functioning system of ego poles, the word world for all, and for each subject as world for all, is constituted. Something I said there was grammatically incorrect, but I think the sentence is all right. I missed a word out or something.
You said transcendental subjectivity, not intersubjectivity.
Yes. Only by starting from the ego and the system of its transcendental functions, here we are, and accomplishments, can we methodologically exhibit transcendental intersubjectivity? This is what we've just done. We've shown how we de-presentify ourselves into another. And it's transcendental communalization, whereby on the basis of that, we then, through that understanding that you are another transcendental subjectivity like I am, we together constitute what we come to understand together to be the world for all. It's still really only happening in the primal sphere of my consciousness. But we come to mean the same things together. And we only come to mean the same things together by means of our actually communicating, because of course our language, we didn't develop language in this primal sphere. Do you see language is... Oh, no, I'm not doing my language course. Language actually leaps out of this. You know, Husserl's saying how you constitute meaning. Well, yeah, all okay. But we only constitute meaning because we have language, and we only have language because we made it together. Language is like... it would be no good, a language, if only I spoke it. It wouldn't be a language. Do you see that language is an...
Yeah, there's no private language in everything.
You've been reading your Wittgenstein. There's no private language as such. We'll go into that in the next course. But language itself is a communal accomplishment without which we wouldn't be able to constitute transcendental subjectivity and our world for all. This is another area where Husserl is, you know, not sure if he's thought it through. Because, you know, this primal, he's looking at this as if you can constitute everything from out of your primal transcendental subjectivity, and yet you can't make language on your own. It has to be made out here in the objective world of our interactions together. That's where a language comes to be, comes to get its form. And then on the basis of the form that we've agreed, we can then come to create new meaning. You know, language is a form of meaning creation, but before language could come to be, there had to be an intersubjective space where we made language together. I hope you don't mind this lecture. It's one of these lectures where, you know, up until now I'm saying this is what Husserl means. This is where I say, well, this is where he can't help us anymore. This is where we've got a whole series of... They're not problems. They're... They're depths, almost. You know, hidden depths in experience that haven't been explicated by Husserl, because he only lived so long and only got so far, and he didn't have another Husserl to tell him all of this either. Do you know, he's pulling this out of himself. All right, I got lost again though, didn't I? Through which in the function third line, through which in the functioning system of ego poles, the world for all, and for each subject as world for all, is constituted. We do that together, but first we have to constitute the meaning of another in ourselves. Got it?
If I realize all of a sudden that someone's just pretending something, or pretending a behavior, pretending saying something, the world really saying, I just feel like I'm dealing with Alexa. You know?
Yes.
Like when somebody does something, they'll realize they're just saying it, or they're just acting as if.
Yes.
So I feel like, oh, suddenly all the kind of magic of life just, you know, colors drop, and I kind of feel like I'm looking at. There isn't a person, something like that. I know there is, but...
There was a conscious decision of them to stay or pretend, wasn't it? Like, they consciously decided that they wanted to pretend, so they are conscious of their pretense.
Yes, I agree with Margarita, that's right. There's still the behind the pretense, there's still another I.
Not the person.
Yeah.
But the inact or the behaviour.
But you're into something that's been troubling me lately.
Of course. Which, I know the person.
But there's this you know, we project our understanding of the cup, and it's pretty encompassing. We don't give the cup a lot of room, if you see what I mean. I know the handle's on the other side. Do you know my idea of the cup that I constitute is pretty fixed? The interesting area is what's my idea of you. Because in a way, there's a level where you don't interact with another human being because you've already predicted everything about them. Do you know what, like the cup, you know the handle, you know where they're coming from, you know what they believe, you know how they're going to respond more or less, and so you meet someone else, and really you're just meeting your projection. And there's weird things go on with the human beings then, because if you strongly project something like that onto somebody, they tend to fall in line with it. Because you were, in a way, you were almost talking about, so somebody's is showing pretense, but even in our ordinary being together, it takes a certain consciousness to allow the other's being to show itself, because you've got to stop predicting who they are. Do you know that's
I choose the pattern of behavior, and actually, if you see others as predictable and maybe boring and maybe not real, the problem lies within you.
Well, I'm still working with this, because a lot of people I allow some space. People do get caught in patterns, you know, of behaviour.
Because that's the most natural and safe thing to do.
Yes.
Follow the pattern of the others, because if the others survived so far, if I follow this pattern, I'll survive as well.
But there are people also who are strongly projecting onto you in such a way that there's nothing you can do, nothing you can say, in a way.
But again, yes, yes, you can. You just
well, no, there's always you can shake someone.
Yes.
You can start to shout. You know, there are various ways through.
You can build mental barriers.
But when somebody's doing that, you've got to love them a lot to want to break through.
Also, if you have already an established idea of someone and they diverge from that, you rationalise that and say, oh, they're feeling themselves today.
Yeah.
And what you imagine that against, that's the fixed idea you have at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, a couple of years ago, I was in I just started waking up a couple of years ago. But before that, I would just honestly say, people are boring. I don't like people. And I was absolutely, ill, because people are not boring. I just stopped projecting my expectations, and I just try to love. I don't have to understand people. I can only love.
So, from my side, and we're drifting into.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still think there's a place for discrimination in terms of who one spends one's time with, because it's like food. You know, different people are vibrating on different levels, and if you spend time with someone who's vibrating on a level that isn't, I mean, I'm not saying I'm up here and someone's down there, but you, if the level, maybe I'm down there and they're up there, you know. But if they don't meet, then you don't get the kind of the real nourishment that you get from being with another person, and it's not that often that you really can attune to someone else. It's not that often. I don't think. So you, what I mean, you do have to discriminate.
I think John, you're missing a little bit there about doing things together, people working together and doing things together.
Yes.
That they get, there's a general purpose together, that there can be quite a lovely connection with people when they're working together on something or looking after someone. My experience would be in nursing, you know, where you're working as a team towards a common goal. There's a different, there's a communication there.
Yes.
Where you that those kinds of things about who's who and who's what, they get a bit wiped out. And there becomes more of a, well, I don't know, at least a, I don't know if it's a love, but an affection for each other. And
now you're reminding me of the
sense
of
worth together.
Yeah.
And that in itself, doing that in itself, breaks down the personalities, and people start to communicate much more directly.
Yeah. It's the crew, isn't it, at Plymouth City Council, when I was cutting the grass. I was driving a cab full of, you know, the gardeners, the guys who cut the grass for the council. And
that's rare too.
Yeah, yeah. So there were no philosophers in that cab as far as I was aware, but there was, after a while, you see, especially through working together, you start to see behind the surface of people, and some quite extraordinary things emerge about who these beings really are, but not through, let's sit down and let's talk about phenomenology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just through cutting the grass. You know, you can get insights into. I mean, I remember. I forget his name now. He was a very rough young man. Just left school. Hardly communicated about anything. And he was just weeding the bank. And there was something so amazing about. Him weeding the bank. I find it very difficult to express, but that it was almost like God was picking the weeds. Do you know that something else was just there, just doing the job? The simplicity of it all, you know, that you don't need to have some kind of, like, just like Nicolette's saying, it's nice if you can get a kind of a level like this where, oh yeah, 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 that it's all firing, but you can see something equally, even maybe even more profound, just in someone's behaviour when they think that they're not being seen. So we'll leave the human race. Thank you, Maria, because I do suffer from your own not the humans, you know, it's, especially en masse on the streets, like, oh. I found that at the university. I don't know if I mentioned that before. I'd often find that the students at the university, when they're all milling through the corridors after you've been off for 3 months and you've just been researching and it's been lovely and peaceful, and suddenly they're all back, you know. and I think, oh no, not that lot, you know. None of them really interested in studying, you can see, and it's the whole but as soon as I get them in a classroom, you know, or a tutorial, suddenly they become individuals again. You know, it's and you see the projection that goes on. Because I keep finding that, you know, different countries I live in, you think, oh no, not the Americans, oh not the Australians, you know, not the English, but the individuals are always.
It's like, I just want to say, because I mentioned the London thing, London stabbing by the. The boy, the man that, you know, lost his marbles. But everybody, there was people there that came out, I don't know whether they were ex-prisoners or whatever, that came out to take action,
mm-hmm.
to stop him doing anything more harm, just because they did, you know, there was a sort of human spirit, the hand,
yes.
is still there.
Yeah, another hand, yes.
There are people there.
Yeah, you know, that people... There are human, there is a lot, the spirit's still there, it's not gone. Despite our advert on the bus there, you know, that Alexa, Amazon.com, you know.
Was it? Did Alexa just go by on the bus?
By an Alexa.
Yeah.
Christmas.
Synchronicity.
Yeah. In Brighton, it's comparing to other cities, even it's much better than London.
Mm-hmm.
In Brighton, you walk into a person and they drinking you want to have.
It's a sanctuary city.
They smile to you in the street. You don't get that. It's very kind of precious thing when you live in a city or town. And people generally smile to you. It's one of these places.
All right, now I'm going to power through now. You'll never have seen me power through a slide, have you? You don't think... Where are we? Yes. Only in this way, which is the way we've just taken of understanding how we constitute another, can we gain an ultimate comprehension of the fact that each transcendental I within intersubjectivity, as co-constituting the world, must necessarily be constituted in the world as a human being. In other words, that each human being bears within himself a transcendental I, not as a real part or stratum of his soul, but rather insofar as he is the self-objectification, as exhibited through phenomenological self-reflection, of the corresponding transcendental I. So, are you there with the fact that the transcendental subjectivity doesn't really exist? It's the agency or the power by means of which what exists comes to be an experience for us, and part of that making the unthinkable source into an experience is that the transcendental subjectivity actually includes itself in the projection, and it projects itself as a firstly as my being a human being, and then everyone else being a human being. So there isn't that, you know, the paradox was, how could these human beings who are part of the world also constitute the world? And the answer to the paradox resolved, is, well, the human beings are just projections into the world, and transcendental subjectivity as such does not appear in the world. That's Husserl's answer.
Jean de Salzman's book, The Reality of Being, it's all about that. She keeps talking about this in very different terminology.
Yes. See, the reality of it is that in somehow or other, this transcendental subjectivity that's projecting the world, it's not, when we say it's not in the world, at the same time, in my being conscious, it somehow is here. My being conscious in some sense is connected back to that. And that's how come we can do what we're doing now, which is regressively inquire back into what that transcendental subjectivity is doing. So it's not as if it were non-existent invisibility that we have no contact with. That was what Kant thought, if I can leap you back into the earlier part of the course. Kant thought that what it is that constitutes experience is some sort of set of transcendental concepts that are just there, if you like, and we can know nothing about them. We can't inquire back into them. The difference that phenomenology has over Kant is, in the epoché, we actually come to be in some sense in union with that which is the source of this experience. Don't we? I rarely ask a question, you might have noticed. Nevertheless, every human being who carried out the epoché could certainly recognize his ultimate I, which functions in all his human activity. The naivety of the first epoché, which ignored the constitution of the other, had the result that I, the philosophizing ego, in taking myself as functioning I, as ego pole of transcendental acts and accomplishments, proceeded in one leap and without grounding, that is, illegitimately, to attribute to the mankind in which I find myself the same transformation into functioning transcendental subjectivity which I had carried out alone in myself. In spite of the methodological illegitimacy, this contained a truth, which, interestingly enough, he doesn't further elucidate. Well, because he does, and again, if we looked at the Cartesian meditations, he does regard, we've got a kind of a shadowy image that there is a transcendental place, and we're all, he could use the word monads, he took the word from Leibniz, we are actually all present but individuated in that transcendental place, which is like a kind of a transcendental intersubjectivity. And if you like, I'm throwing a question over that. And Husserl is equivocating, because Cartesian Meditations was earlier, he's equivocating now. There's certainly, it appears that we're individuals in that you're projecting one thing, I'm projecting another, you're projecting another. There are different, certainly different projections going on. But as for the place out of which the projections are emerging, we're equivocating over whether there are actual, you know, individuals up there or whether it's just the one consciousness. And I think we should equivocate over it. I almost, if I was to give a picture of it, I feel like it's like you're looking up to heaven in the old language. And a certain level, I think there are transcendental selves there. But maybe if you get higher up, there isn't. Do you know there are levels and levels? But that's me speculating. You know, you've got to spot a speculation when you see it. Have I got to the end yet? Yes. All right, we're backing off now, asking of just a few questions. All right, we can sort of if we were in a place there, we're backing off, dying minutes. Are the insane also objectifications of the subjects being discussed in connection with the accomplishment of world constitution? Because obviously the insane, insofar as they're constituting a world, are constituting a world quite different from the world for all that we are more or less agreed on here. But again, I mean, my encounter with people who lost, I think we, as in Australia you'd say, lost the plot, is it's just a bit of a bell curve. You know, most of us are somewhere in the middle of the bell curve, but people get dotted and dotted and dotted. It's not as if we're all at one point. We're all at slightly different places on the spectrum. Of, you know, and this bottom axis is going, you know, catatonia, schizophrenia, you know, maybe there's autism going in another direction. There's a kind of a space of where we are in that dimensionality, and we're all spread out quite widely. And there's a certain point where you say, you've gone, but there isn't really a line. You've gone too far. Do you know? There's a lot of people who we'd say are normal, who are just, they're probably well out on that spectrum as well, and they've just learnt how to keep quiet about it. You know, it's a very difficult question, this of the insane, what it means to be insane. Because a lot of what it seems to be, what it means to be insane, is that there's a psyche behind our surface consciousness. And if you fall into that psyche, you've just gone into another place.
I don't think you'd use the word insane in this type of times.
No, it's sort of fallen out of... It's become a kind of an insult, hasn't it? Yes. But we know what he means. There's a wide disparity of how people experience reality, but most of us at least agree enough to be able to catch a bus. Do you know, there's a tremendous, I mean, it's an amazing agreement in just all turning up to work roughly at the same time. You know, that the buses run, that the trains run, that the electricity comes to the house. Do you know, the coordination that's involved in that is also an extraordinarily sophisticated agreement about a common world that we live in. You couldn't have done that, 300 years ago. You first had to introduce, this is a clock, everyone. This is a clock. No way. I'll see you around midday when the sun's at its zenith. You know, I'm sure, you know, imagine that world. Roughly, if you were within 20 minutes of each other, you've done pretty well. Do you know? Imagine trying to run the world on that basis. You know, it just wouldn't work. We've coordinated ourselves in an extraordinary level of detail. But in a way, that bell curve, we've pushed everyone into the middle. Otherwise, you don't get to earn a wage.
There's a lot of love songs in the 19th century, and the lyrics are all about like.
Well, that was one of it was
if
one.
There
of,
was a club. They wouldn't be able to
kind of
make something.
No, when I first went to university, I studied economics, and the only thing I have got anything out of, I think, was economic history, and where they went into this, the extraordinary amount of work that had to be done to get everybody off the land and working in the factories, and what a terrible thing it was, you know, in a way. There's still a lot of people that where it's still happening to them, but I think the mobile phones pretty much fixed all that, hasn't it? Fixed up the coordinating everyone on Earth. What about children? After all, it is only from the mature and normal human beings who bring them up that they first become acquainted with the world in the full sense of the world for all. That is the world of culture. And what about animals? There arise problems of intentional modifications through which we can and must attribute to all these conscious subjects their manner of transcendentality. Transcendentality? That wasn't a bad go, was it? Precisely as analogues of ourselves. Don't we do that? Particularly with the dogs. I think we've talked about the dogs before. They're little analogues, aren't they? Of ourselves. I think we make... He's so tricky. he's so clever. You know, he's not. He's just.
He just wants that tree.
Yes. So he's just. He's just seen. You know, cause effect, cause effect, cause effect. If I do that, you know, a little bit of a whine, then the treat goes. This naturally extends to encompass all living beings insofar as they have something like life. And poor Husserl, he didn't see them, the computers coming and the robots. Also appearing are the problems of genesis, of transcendental historicity, of the transcendental inquiry which starts from essential forms of human existence in society, of birth and death, of the sexes. Is that maybe the first mention of woman that we've come across? You know, and even then, you know, she's not mentioned directly. There's the problem of the sexes. I wonder what he meant by that. He misses herself, maybe. let's give it kind of some slack. It was a long time ago. And of the unconscious that is so much discussed today. All right, he's talking about Freud. And just pushed him away, I think, with that one sentence. Dreamless sleep, loss of consciousness, and whatever else of the same or similar nature may be included under this title. In accord with all this, it is clear that there is no conceivable meaningful problem in previous philosophy and no conceivable problem of being at all that could not be arrived at by transcendental phenomenology at some point along its way. To which I accept, despite, I mean, this is a long list, really, from Husserl saying, these are all the things I didn't deal with, okay? And there's a lot of them. But do you see, from the start that I've made, how to go about it? How to approach this? Again, it was Heidegger who took the animals on, to an extent. We're still waiting for... the problem of the sexes. I don't remember reading anything that said anything intelligent about that. I feel like I want to hand that whole domain over now to Maria. We want to hear from a woman who has something to say about being a woman in phenomenological terms. So we don't have to do that. But
no. Once I have something to say, I will say.
If you don't have something to say and you find someone who does and you're coming to the next course, we probably won't cover it, but I'd like to read it if you find it. Because I stopped, because I'm not being paid anymore, I've stopped doing research. It's amazing how that I just read the good old stuff that I love. You know, it's a bit like watching your favourite movies, but I keep seeing more in them. So I don't, I mean, I've read a certain amount of contemporary phenomenology, and, you know, if I was... Whereas back with Husserl, I don't know what it is. It's to do with the amount of light that's coming off what I'm reading somehow. So I stay with these originals, because I find there's still more and more and more to be seen in what's being said. But that doesn't, you see what I mean, that doesn't mean there aren't some philosophers that have turned up that have something truly significant to say that I've missed. I'll talk about that when we finish this. No conceivable problem. Last slide. The ultimate self-evidence. I think this is a good statement about science. Having arrived at the ego, one becomes aware of standing within a sphere of self-evidence of such a nature that any attempt to inquire behind it would be absurd. You know, we started this at the beginning of the lecture, that to inquire behind the meaning structures within which we live would be absurd, because that's all we have. It's like trying to ask into what has, which is like to ask what is there beyond meaning. By contrast, every ordinary appeal to self-evidence, which he means like in objective science, insofar as it was supposed to cut off further regressive inquiry, was theoretically no better, and this is where he's getting on a roll, no better than an appeal to an oracle through which a god reveals herself. All, no, he didn't say that. just having a joke with you. That's, all that. Would it be shocking if he'd said that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All natural self-evidences, those of all objective sciences, belong to the realm of what is obvious, quotes, what in truth has a background of incomprehensibility. Every kind of self-evidence is the title of a problem, with the sole exception of phenomenological self-evidence, after it has reflectively clarified itself and shown itself to be ultimate evidence. The point is not to secure objectivity, but to understand it. One must finally achieve the insight that no objective science, no matter how exact, explains or ever can explain anything in a serious sense. I mean, I feel like I would like to get up on the mountain now somewhere and say this, you know, to the whole of Western civilization. You know, and this is, shall I say it again? No objective science, no matter how exact, explains or ever can explain anything in a serious sense. To deduce is not to explain. To recognize the objective forms of the composition of physical or chemical bodies and to predict accordingly, all this explains nothing but is in need of explanation. The only true way to explain is to make transcendentally understandable. Natural scientific knowing about nature thus gives us no truly explanatory ultimate knowledge because it does not investigate nature at all in the absolute framework through which its actual and genuine being reveals itself, reveals its ontic meaning. So, science, objective, exact science, looks into the objective structure of the world and it builds a mathematical description of that structure, and then on the basis of that description what it achieves is it achieves the ability to predict how events will proceed in the universe that aren't observed, that aren't directly observed, because it's built a mathematical model of the universe. And using that model, you can predict what would happen in situations that you may not actually be able to physically encounter. For instance, that there would be black holes, for instance. Or, going back in time, for instance, that there would be a planet, Neptune. Because the mathematical model said, what's happening to Uranus? Its orbit isn't what it should be. There must be another planet. Do you see, this is how mathematical models work. Mathematical models work to start to predict the structure of the atom on the basis of how chemical reactions occur.
What are you saying, structuralism? This is structuralism, isn't it?
But the point that Husserl is making is that, do you see, that explains nothing. It doesn't explain anything. It's just very careful observation, the building of mathematical models, and then then deducing, the deductions that you make from the models become your predictions. And those deductions are very powerful, right? You can deduce from your model of the atom that if you were to, in some way or other, be able to split uranium, you would release in a tremendous amount of energy. You know, that was a deduction from a mathematical model. And lo and behold, atomic bomb. But you see, because you destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that was an extraordinarily real event, doesn't mean you've explained anything. Do you see, we mix up the power that objective science has given us over our ability to control and predict natural processes with an understanding of those processes. To predict is not to understand. That's
not having courage.
Yes. But it's you see, we've got deeply confused and we don't understand how it is. We don't understand the objectivity of the objects that we're studying. Well, we do now.